Chapter 2. Dev looked through the thick glass window into the room where Steele lay on his back, covered by a sheet up to his neck. They were in the fourth floor basement level, accessible only by a concealed elevator on the maximum security floor above it. "See you asleep?" asked Dev. "In a manner of speaking," Higgins said. "He's on downtime." "What do you mean, downtime? You mean you turn him off?" "Not exactly," Higgins said. "His cybernetic brain needs to be at least partially online to maintain his organic functions. For Steele, downtime is the equivalent of being kept under sedation. In effect, he's sedated electronically. We've had him here ever since the assassination attempt when Dr. Carmody was killed. He sustained some damage, and it was necessary to effect repairs. While we were at it, we also performed some upgrades on his prosthetics. That information hasn't been added to the file yet, but you'll be fully briefed. He exhibited some emotional distress over Dr. Carmody's death, so we've had him on downtime ever since." "Was he very dependent on Dr. Carmody?" "The file doesn't indicate that." "Steele's not really the dependent type," said Higgins. "They were lovers." Dev stared at him with disbelief. "She allowed herself to become sexually involved with her patient?" He exhaled heavily. "Jesus Christ. They were both consenting adults, doctor," Higgins said. "That's not the point. For a therapist to become sexually involved with a patient is a serious breach of professional ethics." "Well, I think it did him a ton of good," said Higgins. "After what happened, his wife divorced him, taking their two children with her. Steele took it hard. His relationship with Dr. Carmody gave him something to focus on and reinforced his concept of his own humanity." "And now he's lost her as well," said Dev, shaking his head. "I hardly think it did him any good, Mr. Higgins. How long has he been like this?" "About 2 weeks, but for him, it'll be like waking up the morning after. I didn't want to bring him out of it until you had got here." What do you have to do to bring him out of it?" asked Dev. Higgins turned to Dr. Philip Gates. "Bring him online," he said. Gates sat down behind a computer console and started typing. A program came up on the screen. Gates typed in some commands, and seconds later, Steele began to breathe more deeply. His eyelids flickered open. "All right, doctor," Higgins said. "Let's go in and meet your new patient." Dev glanced at him uneasily and followed him through the door. "Good morning, Steele," Higgins said as they came in. Steele simply gazed at him without expression. "I'd like you to meet Dr. Devin Cooper from Los Alamos. He'll be attached to the project headquarters from now on, and he'll be working very closely with you." "Pleased to meet you, Lieutenant Steele," said Dev, holding out his hand. Steele gazed at him without response. Dev moistened his lips nervously and put his hand down. "How do you feel?"
"You're the new shrink," said Steele.
"That's right.
You didn't waste much time, did you?" Steele asked Higgins. "How long have I been down?"
"About 2 weeks," said Higgins. For a moment, Steele lay still, without speaking. A small furrow appeared between his eyebrows.
"Something's different. Been tinkering again, Higgins?" he said.
He sat up suddenly and threw back the sheet. He was naked underneath. At first glance, he appeared perfectly normal, solidly built, well-muscled, with broad shoulders, dark hair, and slate-gray eyes. Dev knew that the eyes were artificial, sophisticated bionic optic units attached to a cybernetic optic nerve with thermal energy or imaging, laser designator, and image enhancer systems built in. His limbs were Nysteel alloy, sheathed in polymer skin, and his spine was reinforced with articulated Nysteel sheathing. His ribs were also Nysteel, as were his collarbone, scapula, and shoulders. But to look at him, one can never tell. Only a close examination would reveal something different. Steele held up his arms and looked at them. The lines in the skin on the inside of his wrist looked perfectly normal at first glance, but they were too wide and regular on each hand. One of them extended all the way around the back of the wrist. It wasn't immediately visible, and Dev might not have noticed it if it wasn't for the way Steele looked at them intently as he turned on his hands over. Slightly below the center of each palm, there was a small circular indentation in the polymer skin, just above the heel of the hand. "They detach," said Higgins. Dev glanced at him with surprise.
"How?"
asked Steele. "The lock releases are slave to your brain," Higgins said. "Except for Dr. Gates, who can activate the release mechanism while you're here by typing in a sequence of coded commands, you'll be the only one who can do it. As soon as he loads the program that will activate the upgrades, that is."
"What goes on instead? Hooks?"
said Steele dryly. "You'll have a number of optional attachments," Higgins said, "all thought-controlled. You'll notice that your forearms and wrists are larger than they were before. Your hands are slightly bigger as well. We've installed a retracting, compensated 10mm gun barrel into your right forearm. The loading port is just below the crook of your right elbow. The magazine holds 15 rounds. You extend your arm to load one round at a time. The weapon will function with your hand either detached or locked in place. That dimple in your palm retracts to open your gun port. Once the barrel is exposed, you'll be able to attach a silencer if the situation calls for it. The system is of polymer ceramic construction, so it will require no cleaning, and it uses caseless ammunition, so there will be no brass to be ejected. It will, however, require periodic maintenance from time to time. "What's in here?" asked Steele, looking at his left arm. "A dart launcher," Higgins said. "It holds 10 45mm Nysteel rocket darts loaded through the port on the inside of your upper forearm with an effective range of out to 300 yards. The darts are electronically primed with a built-in millifuse, so they'll ignite within 20 to 30 feet of being launched hydraulically. And you'll have the option of tranquilizers, poison tip, or explosive warhead. You can also launch ordinary titanium tip darts, non-rocket propelled, for a distance of 60 to 100 feet. And your optional attachments will also contain ports for those two weapon systems, though they won't resemble human hands." "Sort of like a vacuum cleaner with optional attachments," Steele said wryly. "It should enable you to do a thorough job of cleaning up," said Higgins with a smile. "We've also made a few other modifications. We've used considerably stronger polymer skin grafting to make you more bulletproof, especially around your upper torso to protect your organic parts. And we've reconstructed your jaw where you were shot using Nysteel alloy. You also lost some teeth, so we replaced them all. You won't have to worry anymore about getting cavities." Steele ran his tongue across his teeth. "They look perfectly normal," Higgins said, "but they're polymer ceramic, virtually indestructible. However, if you don't want to have dragon breath from decaying food particles, you should still brush and floss regularly." Dev followed the conversation with astonishment, but he also watched Steele carefully to see how he was taking it. "Did you do a tune-up and an oil change while you were at it?" Steele asked. Higgins smiled. "Absolutely, you're good for another 50,000 miles. "Where are my clothes?" "In the cabinet over there," said Higgins. Steele got up, unselfconscious in his nakedness, walked over to the cabinet and started getting dressed. "When do I get to leave here?" "After the upgrade program has been loaded and you've been checked out on the new systems," Higgins said. "But Dr. Cooper will want to spend some time with you first." Steele zipped up his dark blue coveralls and glanced at Dev. "You sure you want this job, Doctor?" he said. "The last person who had it died." "Yes, I heard," said Dev. "I understand that you and Dr. Carmody were very close. I'm sorry about what happened." Steele glanced at Higgins. "Yeah, so am I." "Well, I'll leave the two of you to get acquainted," said Higgins. He glanced at Steele. "And later on, there's someone else you might like to meet, someone who will also be working with you closely." "Who?" asked Steele. "A gentleman by the name of Ice," said Higgins with a smile. Steele gave him a sharp look. "Ice is here?" "He's in protective custody," said Higgins, "but you wouldn't know it from the way he acts. He thinks he's staying in some fancy hotel with room service. The man eats like a horse." "Ice?" said Dev. "What is that, some kind of code name?" "It's a street name, Doctor," Steele said. "Ice is the man Victor Borodini's soldiers were after when they shot me up." He paused briefly. "He was the last man to see me as I was, though we didn't actually meet face to face." "Well, now you'll have that chance," said Higgins. "I think you'll find him an interesting man, Steele. In some ways, the two of you have much in common." "What kind of deal did you make with him?" asked Steele. "Full immunity in return for his cooperation in helping us with Victor Borodini. He knows a great deal about his operations out in no man's land." "I'll bet he does," said Steele. "Come on, Doctor, let's go someplace where we can talk and get this over with. I've got things to do." The Congressional Lounge on the third floor of the federal building had been the delegates' bar during the days of the United Nations. It was situated on the north side of the building. The entire north wall was glass, affording a panoramic view of the Rose Garden and the buildings beyond it. In the distance stood the crumbled remains of the Queensboro Bridge. The lounge was large and spacious, filled with low coffee tables and comfortable reading chairs upholstered in black leather. The long bar was on the side opposite the windows, and to its left, between the bar and the entrance, a huge tapestry hung on the wall, depicting the Great Wall of China. This early in the day, there was hardly anybody there, and after a nod of greeting to the security guards stationed at the entrance, Steele led Dev over to one of the tables near the windows. A waiter came up and took their order. Steele ordered black coffee. Dev asked for the same. "I figured we could talk here," Steele said. "Congressmen never get up this early, so it's pretty quiet this time of day, unless you feel like going upstairs for breakfast." "Already had mine. What about yourself? You haven't eaten for 2 weeks."
Not really hungry. They feed me through a tube in my throat while I'm on downtime, Steele said. Some kind of mush. I haven't had the faintest idea what it tastes like. I never eat breakfast anyway. I only have coffee in the morning. Where are you from originally?
El Paso.
I thought that accent was Texan. El Paso, that's near the Mexican border, isn't it?
Right smack on it, Dev said. Ever been there?
No, I never left New York. Lived here all my life. What's it like?
El Paso? Well, it's different. Lots warmer, for one thing, and prettier, to my way of thinking. We didn't take any missile damage from the war, although we lost a lot of people to the virus. It's a fair-sized city, though not like this. Not as many people, not as much crime, though we've got our own share.
You have some trouble with the border?
Some, but not as much as you might think, said Dev. The border isn't really closed. The city's more than half Mexican anyway. Those people have it pretty hard down there. Most of the population died off from the virus. We get some screamers and bandits coming across every now and then, but the border patrol's pretty good at taking care of them. Except for the big drug traders, they're not very well armed.
What about the drugs?
We made them legal, Dev said. It solved a lot of problems. We register our addicts. They start hurting, they can come to a clinic, show their card, and get taken care of. It's lots cheaper than having them out committing crimes to get their fix. And it eliminated the criminal drug trade. There's just no money in it anymore. The drug lords down in Mexico pretty much leave us alone. They deal with the freebooters in the Gulf who come up north and sell it to you folks. We actually have more trouble from our American borders.
Higgins said you came out from Los Alamos.
I was on the staff at Project Download there.
I didn't know there was a branch in New Mexico.
It's a big project. There are research branches in several different cities, Dev said.
How'd you get involved in it?
They were looking for someone who specialized in abnormal and stress-related psychology, said Dev. That's my field. There's really no such thing as cybernetic psychiatry, so I guess they were looking for someone who'd work with some unusual cases and could manage to fit in. I was practicing out of a psychiatric hospital in El Paso, and one day I got a phone call asking if I'd be interested in working on a classified government research project. I was intrigued, and one thing sort of led to another.
You haven't really asked me any questions, Steele said.
You seem to have some of your own. I'm not in any rush, said Dev. What do your friends call you?
Steele.
Mine call me Dev.
Does that mean we're friends?
Asked Steele sardonically. You don't much like shrinks, do you? Dev asked.
No, not really.
Mind if I ask why?
Most shrinks I've met can never turn it off, said Steele. They're always poking around trying to figure out what makes people tick so they can fit them into convenient categories and slap a label on them. And I don't like being pigeonholed.
Dev nodded. Well, I suppose you got a point there, he said. I'm afraid a lot of us tend to do that sort of thing. Occupational hazard, I guess.
But you don't do it. Is that it?
I try not to, but it's not always easy. In some ways, I guess it's a bit like being a cop.
How's that?
Asked Steele, frowning. Well, when you spend your life doing a certain thing, like being a policeman, you develop certain patterns of behavior that are an inevitable result of the job. You don't really look at people the way other folks do. You tend to watch for certain things, little telltale signs you've learned to pick up on the job. Signs that tell you things about those people. Signs you've learned to read because they could give you important information. Things like body language. Do the eyes shift a bit when the person's talking to you? That could mean they're lying. Do they pause before answering a question, or do they answer right away? Do they reply too quickly? Is there a sign of perspiration on the upper lip? Do they pick up their breathing slightly? Do their hands move nervously? Things like that. After a while, I suppose a cop tends to look at just about anyone as a potential criminal. Dev shrugged. That doesn't mean he thinks they are. They just learn to watch for certain things. Can't help it. You can't really turn it off either. Steele smiled.
Good point, he said.
Categories can be useful, like generalities, but because some folks just seem to fit them. Dev said, doesn't mean that everybody does. I try to keep in mind that just because I've got a piece of paper that says I know about certain kinds of human conditions, doesn't mean I know it all. I watch out for easy answers. I don't really think there are any.
That's funny, Steele said. Someone else once told me almost the exactly same thing.
Dr. Carmody? Steele shook his head.
No, a man named Liam Casey. He's a priest.
Steele smiled.
You'd like him. He wears cowboy boots, too.
He a Westerner?
No, born and raised in New York City. But he's different. I suppose he's a bit of the cowboy in him. He's a good friend.
Steele paused.
I haven't got that many.
You mean lately?
Especially lately,
Steele said. Dev said nothing. My best friend was killed the same time I was injured, Steele went on. His name was Mick Taylor. He was my partner. He paused. Seems like any one time I get close to someone, they either leave or get killed.
You mean your wife, Dev said. Leaving you, that is.
In some ways, she left me a long time ago, said Steele, looking out a window. Just that I never really noticed.
And Susan Comedy died because someone was trying to kill you, said Dev. Steele nodded.
How does that make you feel? How do you think it makes me feel? How would it make you feel?
I suppose I'd be angry, and I might feel responsible. Steele shook his head.
I don't feel responsible, he said, but I know who is.
Victor Borodini.
That's right, and I intend to make him pay.
You think that'll make it right?
I'm not obsessed with it, if that's what you mean, said Steele, but it's something that needs doing. It won't bring Mick and Susan back, and maybe it won't make me feel any better, but it'll make things right.
Revenge will make things right.
No, said Steele. Not revenge. Justice.
Well, I'll drink to that, said Dev. They saw a lot of each other during the following week, and Steele discovered that Dev Cooper wasn't like any psychiatrist he'd ever met before. For one thing, they never had formal therapy sessions in Dev's office or anywhere else. They talked casually over their meals, over drinks or coffee, and during Steele's training sessions, while he was checked out on his new upgrades. Dev Cooper was a good listener. Steele had braced himself for all the expected questions, but Dev simply never asked them. He had never once referenced to Steele's cybernetic brain, or, for that matter, did he ask any questions beyond the sort of things that could crop up in any casual conversation. But Steele realized early on that Dev Cooper didn't miss much. He had an easygoing, folksy way about him that was both disarming and deceptive. He didn't push, he didn't pry, but he listened carefully to everything that Steele didn't say, as well as everything he said, and he had quite a few surprises for Steele, too. While Steele was practicing on the range with his new built-in weapon systems, Dev had commented favorably on his shooting, and Steele had explained how, with his computer brain and built-in laser designator, it was virtually impossible for him to miss. And then playfully he had suggested that Dev give it a try and handed it to him a police-issue 9mm semi-auto. Dev had checked the weapon competently, and then he stepped up to the line, and using a modified Weaver combat stance, he drilled the X-ring with only one flyer in the eight ring out of 15 shots.
Where the hell did you learn to shoot like that? Steele had asked, impressed.
Hey, son, I'm from Texas, was Dev's answer. Dev wasn't present when Steele finally met Ice, though Steele felt for certain that Dev could hear their conversation. Higgins was very big on hidden surveillance devices. They had Ice on Ice in a room on level B2, one of the maximum security floors. There were two armed guards stationed outside the door. It was a comfortable room, though Spartan, with nothing in it but a bed, reading chair, a table, a portable radio, and a television set. Ice was watching TV when Steele came in. It was the first time Steele had ever actually met him face to face. He thought back to their only other meeting on the day that Mick had died, and his own life was changed forever. Captain Jake Hardesty of the Strike Force had received a call from a man claiming to be Ice, the leader of the Skulls, the most powerful street gang in the No Man's Land just north of Midtown. No law enforcement officer had ever actually seen Ice, though there wasn't a cop in New York City who didn't know about him. Under his leadership, the Skulls had become a well-organized machine, dominating all the other gangs located in their turf and wiping out all those who would not accept their leadership. But lately, the Skulls had experienced dissension in their ranks. They had been approached by representatives of the Borodini Enclave with a business proposition that their war council found difficult to refuse. It was the same deal that Borodini had offered to the most powerful street gangs in the south end of Manhattan, the Green Dragons and the Chingos. The Borodini Enclave would supply them with arms, drugs, and other commodities in return for a percentage of their action, a percentage that seemed very reasonable. But there was a catch. Doing business with Victor Borodini meant taking orders from Victor Borodini, and that was something Ice was not willing to do. However, he had been outvoted by the other members of his war council, and the leadership of the Skulls passed to his deputy, Akeem. Ice simply hadn't taken kindly to being disposed as leader of the Skulls. He had contacted Strike Force, wanting to set up a meeting to discuss a proposition Hardesty sent Steele. With Mick Taylor covering him from their armored unit parked outside, and backup units posted several blocks away, Steele had gone in to meet with Ice alone. They had met in an abandoned storefront, but Ice had stayed back in the shadows, out of sight. His proposition was a simple one. Borodini had scheduled a meeting with the warlords of the Skulls, the Dragons, and the Chingos. The man himself would be there. Ice would tell them where the meeting would take place. All he wanted in return was for the Strike Force to take Borodini out of the picture, along with Akeem and the other warlords who disposed him. Steele didn't like the idea of doing Ice's dirty work for him, but he knew it was not an offer that Strike Force could ignore. A chance at Victor Borodini and the warlords of the most powerful gangs in No Man's Land was simply too good to pass up. Only before Ice could reveal the location of the meeting, Borodini's men had struck. Steele could still hear his partner scream as their unit was blown up and Mick leaped out in flames. There was a second explosion and Mick was heard
hurled forward by the blast to land motionless on the street. And then Borodini's soldiers opened up with everything they had. By the time the backup units arrived, it was too late. Nick had died and Steele was near death himself, in a coma with irreparable brain damage, his body chewed up by armor-piercing bullets. When he woke up, he was a cyborg. And he hadn't seen Ice since that day. Ice reclined on the bed, dressed in black slacks, and a black tank top. He picked up the remote control and turned off the TV as Steele came in. He was a giant of a man, well over 6 feet tall, and almost 300 pounds of solid muscle without an ounce of fat. His massive chest was about 60 inches around, and his bulging arms were larger than most men's thighs. He was clean-shaven, and his head was shaved as well. He wore dark sunglasses and a gold chain around his neck, with a small golden skull dangling from it. When he spoke, he sounded like the voice of doom.
"Well, well,"
he said.
"If it ain't Lieutenant Steele, been wondering when you'd show up."
"Hello, Ice," said Steele. "I thought Borodini's men took care of you."
"Not me, policeman, but I hear they took care of you real good."
"Yeah," said Steele, "only they didn't quite finish the job." Ice got off the bed and came around to stand in front of Steele. He towered over him. The two men sized each other up.
"Last time I saw you, you were shot up pretty bad. Looks like they fixed you up,"
I said, Ice.
"Why, I hear it. You want Mean Machine now."
Steele grimaced. "You always wear those shades?" Ice smiled and took them off. His eyes were like anthracite, cold, dark, and hard.
"Been cooling my heroes for 3 weeks and then some, waiting for you to be up and around,"
said Ice.
"This damn room is getting smaller every day."
"Would you rather be out there in the streets, taking your chances with Borodini's contract on you?" Steele asked.
"I'd rather be out there doing something about it,"
Ice said.
"When are we getting out of this place?"
"We," said Steele.
"You and me, policeman,"
Ice said.
"That's the deal. Cooperation. Like I told Higgins, I ain't gonna sit here singing like some bird while someone else goes out and checks out all the leads I give them. This here's a hands-on proposition. Anything you get, I want a piece of it. All except for Victor Borodini. I want that man all myself."
"You're not in any position to make demands, Ice," Steele told him.
"Who's gonna stop me? You?"
"Maybe, if you rattle my chain too hard," said Steele. "But I wouldn't really need to. If Higgins wanted to, he could open you up like a tin can, give you a little shot, and you tell him everything you know with a great, big, stupid smile on your face. In fact, I wonder why he didn't do that."
"I tell you what, policeman, because it ain't what I know so much as who I know and who I can get to,"
I said.
"I still got some friends out there, connections. Knowing who they are ain't gonna help your people. They need me to get to them. And I need you to balance off Borodini's muscle. We need each other, Steele. You scratch my back, I scratch yours."
"If I wanted a partner," Steele said, "you'd be the last one I'd pick. I work alone."
"Your man Higgins might have something to say about that,"
I said. "I'll take it up with him."
"You do that. But you go out to no man's land alone, you won't find nothing without someone to steer you in the right direction. Get the right doors open. You think about it, Steele,"
I said, getting back up on the bed.
"Give it some thought, but don't take too long about it. It's getting real close in here."
He put his shades back on and turned on the TV. "It's out of the question," Steele said. "There's no way I'm going to work with that man." Higgins sat behind his desk. Dev Cooper sat in one of the armchairs across from it. He didn't participate in the discussion. He simply watched and listened. "I think you ought to reconsider," Higgins said. "Ice could be a definite asset to this operation. He knows his way around and he could..." "Forget about it," Steele said, interrupting. "You want to make a deal with him for what he knows? That's up to you. But I'm not working with him and that's final." For a moment, Higgins said nothing. Then he took a deep breath and let it out slowly. "It's not your option, Steele," he said in a measured tone. "I can understand your objections to working with ICE. He is, after all, a wanted criminal, but the police have certainly worked with criminals before. You've used informers, you've cut deals. This is no different. ICE was the number one man among the Skulls for many years, and before he was forced out, he managed to acquire a great deal of knowledge about Borodini's operations in Harlem. He's got contacts, and he's got resources out in no man's land that we don't even have access to. I'm not asking you to like the man or even trust him, but I do expect you to work with him. If you insist on being uncooperative, I could easily have Dr. Gates program you with an imperative that would leave you with no choice, but I would prefer not to have to do that, unless, of course, you force my hand. I trust we understand each other." Steele gave him a long, hard look. "Do we understand each other?" The corner of Steele's mouth twitched. "Yeah," he said. "Good. I've made it clear to Ice that he will be under your authority." Higgins smiled faintly.
He's about as happy about that as you are, but he's got a score to settle with Victor Borodini, and I think we can count on that to keep him in line.
What if he gets out of line? Asked Steele.
It'll be your job to see that he doesn't, Higgins said. I think you can handle that.
Right,
said Steele flatly. We've repaired the damage done to your apartment, Higgins said, and I've had the security beefed up, so there won't be any repetition of what happened last time. We've informed the media that after the helicopter attack, we're not taking any chances, and any of their choppers that intrude upon the airspace around your penthouse will be fired upon. Under the circumstances, since that chopper that Victor Borodini's men was hijacked from Channel 4, they will be very understanding. I've also arranged for separate quarters for ICE in the same building. When he's not with you, I'd kind of like to have him where we can keep an eye on him.
Anything else? Said Steele.
I guess that about covers it, said Higgins. As of now, you're back on active duty.
Fine,
said Steele. He turned and left the room.
You gotta handle that a little better,
Dev said after Steele had gone.
Steele's a federal officer, Doctor, Higgins said, and I expect him to follow orders.
I'm not arguing with that, said Dev, but it was a mistake to threaten him with a programmed imperative.
That is one of our options, Doctor, Higgins said, and if it becomes necessary, I intend to use it. We've got too much invested in Steele to risk letting him become too independent. He's got to learn to accept what he is.
Oh, he's accepted it, all right,
said Dev, but accepting something and learning to live with it are two very different things. All things considered, he's handling what happened to him remarkably well, but he's a long way from having learned to live with it, and I'm not sure he ever will. He hides it well, but under an incredible amount of stress. That worries me. That worries me a lot.
You think he might have problems? Higgins said.
Already got problems, Dev said. The question is, can he learn to deal with them?
I don't know. I'd be a whole lot happier if I could spend more time with him.
I can understand that, Doctor, Higgins said, but I need Steele on the streets. You assured me he was fit for duty.
I gave you my best assurances, said Dev. But that's still no guarantee there won't be any problems. He's a man with human emotions locked inside a cybernetic brain. There's really no way to predict how we might respond. He paused.
I really just don't know. I've never been faced with anything like this before. You tell me, what happens when a computer has a nervous breakdown?
End of chapter.